in torrents. She was very nice, but she offered no practical solutions. Andrew, who accompanied me a couple of times, was a large part of the solution. Ultimately, therapy just compounded my issues, particularly as Andrew was immovable about children. I knew he was worried about the prospect of ending up a single parent. Even so, I knew he was by my side, solid as a rock. Surrogacy required us to be married, and he seemed averse to this subject too. His lack of commitment was killing me. Was he deep down a romantic who just needed to do things in his own time? My situation demanded the comfort of knowing. I wrestled with my inner voice, which was telling me at times to walk away. My former self would have had no problem with this, but infertility and cancer made decisions far more complicated. I wanted to see this through, to keep going, and get back to where we were at the beginning, if that was possible. What I hadn't realized was that the doctors had been far more honest with him than with me. They'd been upbeat and positive to my face, giving me the impression I would survive, while telling Andrew and my family a different story. This, it turns out, is not uncommon for cancer patients. They are often the last to know of the seriousness of their situation. A turning point came one evening when Andrew and I were at home. We had just watched a movie, I was tired and was just about to get off the sofa and head to bed, when he turned to me and held me back. "I've been thinking a lot about kids. I'm sorry I found it so hard to discuss before, but I've decided I'm ready," he said.
"What? Really? You really want children? You're not just saying that to cheer me up?"
"Believe me, I've thought about it non-stop. I've always wanted children. I know you've not been given the all clear yet, and I'm still worried about you. I've had to think about the worst-case scenario, but I think I can handle being a dad on my own if it happened again." I threw my arms around him and vowed I was not going to die. No way. This was what I had been hoping for. We were planning a future. The relief was immense. We stayed up late discussing the options. Andrew thought that adoption would be the best route, although I strongly favored surrogacy. In his eyes, we would be coming at the problem together, that somehow having his genes and not mine in our child would be selfish if we pursued the surrogacy route. What he didn't realize was that choosing him included choosing his genes, that what made Andrew Andrew was part of the equation. If I were to select a biological mother, then wasn't I in effect selecting both sets of the baby's genes? The child would still be my creation. Still, I knew the process of surrogacy would not be easy. Would anyone take on a woman who'd been through cancer? I didn't want to rule out any options, limited as they were, so I wrote letters and waited. I contacted the adoption agencies, and despite Andrew's concerns, I wrote to COTS, Childlessness Overcome Through Surrogacy. A surrogacy organization founded by Kim Cotton in 1988. I expected to have a battle with the agencies, guessing that they would probably refuse me on health grounds. I wasn't wrong. A refusal from an adoption agency soon arrived, stating that I needed to be clear of cancer for at least 5 years before I could even be considered. This was exactly the response I'd been expecting. In 5 years, I would turn 35, too old for the agency's strict criteria to be considered anyway. Yet again, time was not on my side. It seemed too young to me. Lots of women were becoming mums at 40. But there it was. In fact, Andrew had a much better chance of adopting as a single male than we had as a married couple. While apologetic, the letter went on to argue that the child might suffer further emotional loss on top of what he or she had already gone through if I were to die. I understood this view and realized there was little point in contesting this decision. Even so, I couldn't help looking through the pictures of the children again, their little faces staring up into the camera, so desperate to be loved. My heart bled. I could have offered them a stable, safe, and loving home. I would never get anywhere with their rigid rules and blinkered attitudes. Angry, I threw the letter in the bin. With adoption out of the equation, I persuaded Andrew to focus his energies on surrogacy. He still worried that it was an inequitable arrangement, but with no other available options, he was on board. Surrogacy, I hoped, would eventually provide the missing pieces in my life. And so began the task of finding a suitable surrogate, and perhaps an egg donor too. COTS was a young agency, and getting ourselves onto their books took ages. The public largely viewed these arrangements as not only bizarre, but risky. Biased and sensationalist press articles didn't help. One story I read was about a surrogate who had kept the baby. This was something that worried us too. How far could you trust anyone in these circumstances? The article suggested that the problem stemmed from ignoring the pregnant surrogate, leading her to think the baby wasn't wanted enough. It didn't seem to have anything to do with an emotional bond between the mother and the baby. Since that report, more background checks on surrogates had been put in place, so finding women prepared to take on such an extraordinary act of selflessness, having them properly assessed to verify their good intentions, all took time. I would spoil my surrogate rotten if I ever found one. I knew I should be waiting until the magical 5-year all clear mark before we started this process, but there was no harm in exploring how to go about it in the meantime. I had already quietly gathered information without telling Andrew. I desperately needed this scrap of hope. COTS finally sent through a list of possible surrogates with their profiles, where they lived, their age, weight, education, work, hobbies, etc. One Thursday evening I was busy leafing through some of the profiles and reading the COTS newsletter when my phone rang. It was my dad. He never called, it was always Mum. I knew something serious must have happened. In a broken voice, he told me that my mother's breast cancer had spread and was now in her liver. I nearly dropped the phone. I knew that once the disease reached the liver, lungs, or brain, this meant only one thing. She was stage 4 terminal and only 60. She was far too young to die. Chapter 3. Tell me the truth. I instantly felt a strong sense of solidarity with my mother. I knew how alone and isolating it felt to be diagnosed. Even worse, she was now facing a death sentence. I could only imagine how terrible this was. I immediately began a frantic search for anything that might help her, knowing full well that time was not on her side and conventional medicine on its own would be futile. The internet in 1996 was pretty sparsely populated, but there were a few stories of people surviving cancer by adopting a radical change in diet. The more I looked, the more I began to wonder why some of these treatments and altered diets weren't suggested or explored by more cancer patients. As I delved into the world of alternative treatments, I began to uncover facts about cancer that no one had ever told me. For example, I learned that glucose feeds most cancers and that IGF-1, an insulin-like growth factor hormone found in high levels in dairy and meat, was implicated in driving its growth. Wow, why hadn't I known this before? Cancer cells have many glucose receptors on their surface to feed them glucose and give them the enormous amounts of energy they need to replicate. Reading further, I learned that they're always hungry. Their insatiable appetites for nutrients helps them carry out their relentless proliferation, giving them both the building blocks and the energy to keep on doubling in size. It seemed all the focus for conventional treatments was on the genetic mutations and division in the cell nucleus. What about targeting the altered metabolism too? Why was this not addressed? I learned that cancer doesn't survive in oxygenated environments. It prefers anaerobic conditions and a process called glycolysis, a breakdown of glucose in the cytosol, not in the mitochondria, to ferment and grow, a bit like yeasts ferment. This fermenting process is a grossly inefficient way of making energy, almost as if the cell had reverted to primitive times when the world had no oxygen. I learned how cancer sends messages and signals to build new blood vessels to feed itself, a process called angiogenesis, and that it needs other factors to feed its exponential growth. And I discovered the importance of maintaining a functioning immune system, ironically something that's ruined by too much chemotherapy. None of this had ever been discussed with me. As a fully trained physiotherapist, I felt I should have known all of this or learnt it when I was diagnosed. I felt I'd been very remiss, but it seemed that even the medics themselves didn't understand these facts, or at least disputed their importance. When I questioned them, they told me that diets had never been shown to help. I asked if there had ever been any trials. There hadn't. Trialing diets was notoriously difficult, but that was no proof they didn't work, right? And what about targeting the immune system? No use. The immune system was so overwhelmed by cancer that it failed to treat it as an invading force. Believing the cancer to be just another part of the body, the immune system no longer attacked it, so there was little point targeting it. This seemed a defeatist argument to me. But perhaps the tumor needed to be switched off somehow, to allow the immune system to be switched back on. How could that be achieved? Perhaps by slowing or turning off the altered metabolism of cancer? Oncology was not a speciality I'd been familiar with as a psychotherapist. As a result, I had placed all my faith in my colleagues in the medical profession to get me well. At the time, I hadn't even questioned the treatments I was given. I spent little time researching how effective they really were, or whether there were complementary therapies that might help. I had naturally assumed I was getting the best treatment possible. I believed the doctor's reassurances that I'd be cured. Over the following weeks, as I watched my mother die, the burden of my grief only intensified. It was a depressing realization that the oncology profession was not tackling cancer on enough levels. My emotional state must have been massively detrimental to my immune system, and I felt guilty that my own cancer diagnosis must have, in turn, deeply affected my mum. Nothing I said could persuade her to cut out or reduce sugar and high glycemic, refined carbohydrates in her diet, and taking supplements was not something she was prepared to do. In any case, I think it was probably too late to rescue her. Like many of her generation, she worshipped her doctor. She blindly did everything he told her, like eating cake and biscuits to feed her up and give her energy. I was the only one telling her to try something different. But I was merely a physiotherapist, while other members of my family are doctors. They weren't overtly against what I was saying, but I felt they thought my efforts were misguided and of little value. It was frustrating and painful to see my mother wasting away, but by this time, there had been too much damage to her body from both the cancer and from the chemotherapy. Slowly she grew weaker and weaker, until she was bedridden, and one evening in early October, she finally died, peacefully at home, with me, my dad, and my brother holding her in her last moments. Even though it was a peaceful event, it was devastating to witness. I will never forget it. I had felt so hopeless and powerless. Again, I hit rock bottom. Modern medicine had let me down, and my mother too. Death suddenly felt very real indeed, no longer something that happened to other people. I was still in my early 30s, and suddenly I wasn't feeling as invincible as I had when I first got cancer. I knew I had to do more research and prepare myself if cancer came back. Thanks to the confusing and misleading grading and staging of cervical cancer, only now did I begin to realize that my stage 1B cancer was in fact stage 3, as it had been in many of my lymph nodes. I was only one step away from a terminal diagnosis of stage 4. In the months after my mother passed away, not only was I grieving her loss deeply, but I was haunted by visions of myself on that deathbed. Instead of seeing her,